First today, the power of the creative duo. From Lennon and McCartney to Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, creativity is in the hands of couples. When it comes to innovation, two is the magic number. Joshua Wolfshank is the author of Powers of Two, Finding the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs. He's the advisor for the storytelling organization The Moth. His first book, Lincoln's Melancholy, was named one of the best books of 2005 by the New York Times. And I should point out that Josh will be speaking about his book at 6:30 tonight at the Kansas City Public Library. More on that in just a few minutes. And Josh, so good to have you here. Welcome to Kansas City.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Well, we tend to think of the geniuses among us, I don't count myself as one of those, by the way, as the great solo acts. But you say once you really examined their lives and how they worked, it oftentimes was in tandem with others or at least somebody else. Steve Jobs is a great example of this. Tell us about him.
Steve Jobs is one of the great lone genius icons.
Exactly.
He seemed to be, personifies Apple and innovation and the digital age. Even he's seen as the inventor of the digital age. But when you look at his career, every step of the way, he was with critical partners, starting with Steve Wozniak, with whom he created the original Apple, moving through the Pixar years and on to his return to Apple, where he met a young designer named Jonathan Ive, who created the look and feel of the iPad and the iPhone and the iMac. And it was really that duo that defined Apple, not Steve Jobs alone.
So this notion that he was this guy up in his garage or in his study at 2 o'clock in the morning figuring out the iPhone and everything else, that just isn't the case.
No, he had a certain capacities. He was, he had a vision. He dreamt big. He was very good marketing ideas, representing ideas, selling ideas, but he tended to rely on others for the substance of the idea itself.
So what is it then, Josh, about the power of two, about two people working together that just tends to make for more creative sparks here?
Yeah. Well, that sense of chemistry and being aroused and opened by another person is at the heart of creative expression, even in fields that require a lot of solitude. So, painters like Vincent van Gogh rely on art dealers like his brother Theo van Gogh, with whom he was entirely entwined. A writer like Thomas Wolfe may spend months or even years on his own working on a manuscript, but it only is going to be shaped and worked into publication by someone like Maxwell Perkins, who was his editor and who he was entwined with. These relationships aren't simple. They're often emotionally very complicated. Sometimes they lead to tumultuous breaks. And telling stories about them, really takes us into that emotion and that drama, which is a lot of fun, but it's also hard. And that's why a lot of times historians go back to the simple form of the biography, sort of presenting history as though it's one person on a stage. It's easier to tell a story that way, but the stories are thinner. I think ultimately less interesting and definitely less true.
Yeah. But so you can begin to imagine then just how tricky it is for a creative person to find the right person to interact with. We're talking about something maybe as complicated as a marriage in some cases, right?
Oh, certainly. Yeah. And that metaphor comes up all the time, that this is a creative marriage. And I think in some ways it's even more complicated because with marriage you have this.
My producer is signaling in the booth behind you. It's she and I are this creative pair taking on the world right now, just so you know.
Well, and that's also a classic case that you're on the air and she's in the booth. And that's one of the ways that we're fooled, because the structure of these relationships often require one person to be off the air, in this case literally or many times metaphorically. And that doesn't mean that the relationship isn't critical and ongoing and minute by minute.
No, let's make it real clear. This show is all about me. I'm the only one driving this train. Let's get this clear.
All right, I'm glad to know this
okay.
is an exception.
This is a solo act every day. Not. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Well, tell me about Lennon and McCartney, as I get you off track here. Tell me about Lennon and McCartney and how these two guys met, because they may be the quintessential example that we're talking about here.
They are, and it's also, remarkably, given that they agreed to co-credit all their work from the time they were teenagers all the way through, we still try to tease them apart and say, well, who was the genius and who did
yes.
what? and try to assign percentages to every given song. If you look up any Beatles song in Wikipedia, it will tell you this is credited to Lennon McCartney, but then the geniuses of Wikipedia are going to tell you who really wrote the song, in quotes, really. These guys are a classic illustration of chemistry, and their story runs all the way through the book because they light up all of the themes.
Yes.
Beginning with this thing called complementarity, which is the key to this feeling of chemistry or electricity, this creative love at first sight, which is really common, and it happened with them. John Lennon was a brash, swaggering, poetic kid, kind of was always, you know, sticking his finger in the eye of authority, and he was really fell into a swoon when he heard Elvis Presley for the first time, and he wanted to be in a band. They called it skiffle then. It was sort of it was on its way to rock and roll music, and he was playing with his band at a church fair when Paul came around because a mutual friend had told him that he ought to check it out. Paul was amazed at this kid who was vamping, making up lyrics to this doo-wop song. He was just amazed at the brashness of it and the creativity of it. And then afterwards, Paul showed off his stuff to John, and John was amazed that this kid knew so many chords, had memorized so many songs, and could do these perfect imitations of Little Richards and Carl Perkins. And that is their relationship right there. That's the DNA of it. Of course, it needed to be replicated many times, and it would grow, and it would evolve. But this, you know, the guy who's always wanting to break rules, and the guy who's always looking for a system of rules to apply to any given situation, and it was a great marriage, full of tension, full of competition, but enormously creative.
You tell this great story, this great anecdote later in the book about the two of them, and I hope I can recall this correctly, Josh, but I think the two were on the rooftop toward the end of the lifespan of the Beatles, and John Lennon is singing a song, and he forgets the words to song.
Sure,
and Paul just immediately, he sort of makes up words and gets through the verse, but then looks at Paul, and Paul brings him right through the song the second time, and they get it right. And it was just a great example of the two of them just being, even at a time of tremendous tension within the group, the two of them could still connect in this very elemental way, as you write about so well here.
It's a great moment, and your listeners can call it up on YouTube when the segment is done, when your next segment is done, please. it's the Beatles rooftop concert. It's the last time they played together. And they were really fighting. There was money trouble. They were in the throes of, you know, what came to be known as the breakup, although I argue that they never actually broke up in the way that we think of it. And John forgot the lyrics to a song, to one of his songs, and he totally flubbed it, and he started doing nonsense. And he went through a whole refrain of nonsense, and then they locked back into the song. And and as they got back into the groove, John looks over, and he's just beaming, and Paul's nodding his head up and down.
Yeah,
they had a rhythm together and a wordless communication that was, you know, it ran down to their bones.
Let me get our listeners involved here. If you want to join our conversation about great creative duos, our guest again, Joshua Wolf Shank. He's author of Powers of Two, Finding the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs. Maybe you have some examples you want to ask Josh about or wonder about the power of two and how that works. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. So what other sort of elements are part of the creative pairing as you look at Lennon and McCartney, Josh, that you would point to that the characteristics of their chemistry together?
Sure. Well, the book follows it, you know, the arc of relationships from the first meeting to the place where they have to negotiate what I call a joint identity. They have to, you know, kind of come into a first person plural. And you probably notice in your own relationships there's a moment when you start saying we as opposed to I, and moving back and forth, and sometimes not knowing, is this mine or is this ours, and being unclear about it. Every creative pair goes through that stage if they're going to be serious, if they're going to do meaningful work. Having distinct and clear roles that are also flexible is also critical. Having enough solitude is also important, and this might sound contradictory, but it's not. And one of the really important things for us to understand is that solitude is not contrary to relationship. It's an ingredient in it. And so this is one reason why we're confused, because we think, oh, well, a writer works alone, a painter works alone. It's true that their practice requires a lot of solitude, but that may heighten the importance of the person to whom they bring the work when they come out of solitude, the person who is sort of outside of the studio, watching the culture, watching the world, dealing with money, dealing with current trends, and then allows that person to retreat to the studio and do this solitary work that's up in his or her own mind. And my favorite example of this is Emily Dickinson,
who was not publishing
a great deal, but was very much dependent on and aroused by and enlivened by a series of relationships that she conducted largely through correspondence. So you see someone who needed a lot of solitude, needed to be alone in her mind, but also really needed those hot, electric connections with other people, and was very fastidious and clear about the people she chose, and it really shaped her life. So the idea of her as this sort of eccentric, baddie, isolated person is really quite wrong.
You know, it seems to me that another characteristic here is this idea that there's a certain selflessness about working with someone else, where you're acknowledging just by the fact you're working with someone else that you don't have all the answers. I remember once reading an interview with Lennon, you know, where he ran through all the different songs. The interviewer was saying, what about this song? What about that song?
Right.
And he was just very, it seemed to be very candidly pointing out that, well, yeah, I wrote that one. Or he would say, no, Paul wrote most of that song. I did the bridge, da-da-da-da-da. It was just very matter-of-fact pointing out the contributions of his partner and noting what he had done himself. And there is you sort of have to acknowledge someone else's contributions to make the whole thing work.
Yes. The ego is a big thing in creative work, and you really can't do something if you don't have an ego. But then you also have to surrender that into the sense of the collective. And a lot of times there's a real struggle. There was for John Lennon and Paul McCartney. At times they were really good about saying, this is the two of us together. And a lot of times you see great creative pairs, they will not share with any third person who did what, because they don't want the work to be taken apart in that way. At the same time, when John and Paul split up, they really had an enormous problem that's hard for us to imagine, because we now know so much about who did what. But at the time, no one knew. And John would walk into the Plaza Hotel and the band would strike up playing Yesterday on strings. And it was horrifying to him that no one knew who he was. I mean, it was really an existential crisis for him. And so they went out kind of really energetically, even furiously, trying to identify, well, this is what I did. And John, years later, reflecting on those early interviews after the breakup, you know, said that he was really making a lot of stuff up, that it was, you know, he had gone way too far in trying to delineate specifically who had done what.
Mm-hmm.
The truth is, you know, there were some specific things they could remember and identify, but a lot of things emerged out of this constant give and take. And even when they were alone, you know, John Lennon in his studio at home in the suburbs of London, there was one photograph on the wall, and it was a photograph of he and Paul. And so even when he's alone, he's sort of writing into the relationship.
Hey, you said a little while ago that the two of them, the Beatles, never broke up in the conventional sense that most of us tend to think of it as. What did you mean by that?
You know, moving from kind of intense connection and, you know, you're all in a room together, you're all in a studio together, you're all on tour together, to a period of solitude is a natural rhythm. And sometimes it comes with some, you know, you may not like gently part from your partner and say, oh, I'm going to go on a walk now. You may storm off, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're leaving the relationship. It may mean that you need some time by yourself. And that's pretty much what was happening in the late 60s and early 70s. These guys came to a stoppage, and it had gotten to be too much. John said it was like, you know, four guys were locked in a room together, you know, all these years. But there really is there's no definitive moment where they said, we don't want to play together anymore. And in fact, if you look all through the 70s, there was constant suggestion that they wanted to play together again. And there are all these near misses. And the last tragic near miss is John Lennon's assassination. He has said that he had come back to music for the first time in years, and part of that comeback was making an album with Yoko, and part of it was going to be writing songs again with Paul, and he really hoped the band would get back together again just a couple of months after he was assassinated.
And what a tragic loss for all of us that we never heard those songs they might have written together. Again, our guest, Joshua Wolf Shank, he's the author of Powers of Two, Finding the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs. We're talking about dynamic duos, basically. He'll be speaking tonight at 6:30 at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the Central Branch at 14 West 10th Street downtown. It's a beautiful building. To RSVP, go to kclibrary.org. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888. Howard from Overland Park, welcome to the show. You're on with Joshua Shank.
Thank you. How much of an influence did Ira Gershwin have on George Gershwin? Did Ira Gershwin, you know, get shorted? And also, a mystery to a lot of us, Holland Dozier Holland, the great Milltown writing team. Maybe you could say something about them, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Howard.
The Gershwins are a great example of this phenomenon. They divided up the work, the music and the lyrics, but they were entirely entwined. And Ira Gershwin offered a definition of a song that really is a great definition of partnership itself, that you have these two forces that come under pressure and they coalesce into a single thing.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of pressure, and not to belabor the point with Lennon and McCartney, but you also talk about the competitiveness between the two of them as being a vital factor in what they did.
Yes, George Martin, the Beatles producer, said that they were like two guys pulling on a rope, pulling as hard as they could, but smiling the whole time. And then he said the tension.
Great analogy.
It is.
Yeah.
The tension made for the bond. Conflict is very common. It's not necessarily a bad thing. A lot of times the people that you're most able to fight with are also the people you're most able to have fun with. And a lot of times the people who kind of who jar you, get your blood up, who maybe even make you angry, are people who are going to arouse you to the next stage of things. And there are a whole series of cases of people who are actual competitors, like Larry Bird and Magic Johnson, or a parallel in the art world, Henri Matisse and Pablo Picasso, who you could really think of as oppositional collaborators.
Yeah.
They were doing separate things, and they actually were trying to top the other guy, but they were so dependent on the other guy to set the standard in that constant exchange that they really became closer to the two of them became closer than anyone else. And Matisse and Picasso and Bird and Magic, in both cases, it's like a marriage in a sense of total entwinement and dependence.
Yeah, I thought that was such an interesting idea that you used Larry Bird and Magic Johnson in this book, because, again, they weren't on the same team. They were never on the same team. Even in All-Star games, they were on opposing teams. And yet, you point out that when they would, you know, during the course of a season, the first thing that Larry Bird would look at each day in the box scores was how many points did Magic have the night before, how many assists. They were constantly comparing one to the other.
Right, and Magic said that he would get the season schedule, and he would go and he would circle the Boston games. That's all that mattered to him. And they entered the league the same year. They were already gunning for each other because they had played in college. And their worldview really tunneled to the other guy and beating the other guy. And 12 years in, Magic contracted HIV and announced his retirement. And Larry Bird said that he was going to retire too. He said, "There's no point being in this game if he didn't have a chance to beat Magic."
That's just such an interesting idea. And to this day, sports enthusiasts always sit around and talk, well, who was the better player? Who had the most success? And a clear answer to that never really has quite emerged, has it?
Yeah. Well, you really can't declare an easy winner because the real hero is the relationship. The real hero is the two of them.
Yes,
and what I'm trying to do in the book is tell the story of those heroic characters, the story of Matisse and Picasso, the story of Bird and Magic. And that's the reason why I'm focusing so exclusively on two people, because you can tell a story. You can see where they met. You can see where it led. And it has a kind of mythic power that's a counterpart to this really unhelpful idea of the lone genius.
Hey, but you're not saying that the lone genius can't achieve great things. I'm thinking, of course, of Beethoven. I mean, there are examples out there.
Sure. I mean, there are examples of people doing extraordinary work, and that the work is properly credited to them. You know, my name is on the cover of my book. I had a critical relationship that affected everything I did with my editor, but his role is not credited in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's appropriate to credit Beethoven for what he did. It's appropriate to credit Einstein for the theory of relativity. But if you look at how Einstein actually developed the theory of relativity, he did it in conversation with his best friend named Michel Besseau, who was an engineer. Einstein brought him to the patent office and really depended on him, as he said, as a sounding board. Now, does that mean that Besseau was his equal? Not necessarily. Does it mean that they co-authored this theory? Not necessarily. But it means that the energy of the relationship allowed something to happen that couldn't have happened without it. And that's what I'm interested in.
Can you point to a pair of people who couldn't make it work together for one reason or another, and maybe, Josh, you would have killed to see what they could have done together if they could have made it work?
That's a great question. I can't think of anything off the top of my head, but let's see if something comes to mind. I mean, it is
stall for a second.
In part because I the book is focusing on these illustrative stories of epic collaborators, but it's much more common than not that that these things don't work. And one of the, when I teach on this material, one of the things I emphasize is notice your experience of chemistry with lots of people. And you can even, imagine it like a gas gauge, take notice of when it feels like you're on empty and you're just sort of sputtering and you're a little slower and in the presence of another person, and pay attention to when you're way full up and your mind is overflowing and you're quicker and sharper. Those will be rare, but when you have that experience, you really should pay attention to it and follow up on it, even when it's not necessarily fun or easy, because a lot of times being stimulated in that way, it kind of pushes us in a way, that's out of our comfort zone, so to speak.
Joshua Wolfshank's new book, Powers of Two, Finding the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs. Again, he speaks tonight at 6:30 at the Kansas City Public Library, the Central Branch downtown, 14 West 10th Street. To grab a seat or to RSVP, go to kclibrary.org. Josh, I really enjoyed having you.
Same
Best
here.
Of luck with the book.
Thanks so much. It's
you
fun
bet.
Talking.